Product details at MrRogersWindows.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Even though some athletes may not see themselves as role models, they are. It just comes with the territory. Athletes are heroes to young people. More importantly, sport itself is held up as something almost sacrosanct, an institution that builds character, something in which all participants, win or lose, are made better through their participation, and something from which society at large also benefits. Trouble is, every so often something happens in sports and with athletes that shakes that image to its very foundation. UNC Chapel Hill just went through that, so did Penn State, and then there are the troubles professional athletes find themselves in from time to time. But there are those who are constantly working to keep things on track, and in fact, to expand the positive role sports can play on and off the field or the court. Northeastern University Charlotte is hosting a discussion among some sports professionals about ethics and the role of sports in society, and several of those participating are with us this hour. Dr. Cheryl Richards is CEO and Regional Dean of Northeastern University in Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike.
For those who don't know, you're right here downtown, smack dab in the middle of things. When did Northeastern University arrive in Charlotte?
So we arrived in Charlotte last October of 2011, and at that time we opened our doors right at the corner of Trade and Tryon, as you said, right in the heart of Uptown Charlotte, offering 8 graduate degree programs that were very industry aligned. One of those is a master's in sports leadership, which is how we have started to evolve some of our curriculum to change and meet the demands of industry. I will tell you, Mike, that the WFAE listeners this morning will be the first to hear that we have just expanded our degree programs for the Charlotte and North Carolina region, and we have 10 additional programs, 2 doctoral programs, the first 2 doctoral programs from an institution outside of North Carolina that have been approved in the state, and we're bringing those this fall in addition to 8 additional master's programs.
And they would be?
Oh, they're in a variety of disciplines. We have our College of Engineering, so we're bringing some energy systems and engineering management programs to the region. We have some in the technology field, information assurance, which is really around cybersecurity and computer science. We have some for civic engagement and government affairs and masters of public administration, criminal justice, et cetera, and then a lot in the healthcare field. So.
Well,
growing.
Well, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Welcome to Charlotte. And Dr. Richards is also here with one of her colleagues at Northeastern University. Peter Roby is the athletic director there, and he joins us by phone from Boston, which is your real home, I suppose, right? Mr. Roby, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
And Fred Whitfield is president and COO of the Charlotte Bobcats Sports and Entertainment. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Mike.
When do we get Michael Jordan on this program?
Well, you know what? Interestingly enough, he loves Charlotte, and he's around a lot, and he's gotten heavily engaged in our community.
When do we get Michael Jordan on this program?
Always a possibility.
Good job, Fred. Keep bobbing and weaving there, kid.
Well done, well done. Well, let's get serious about the topic. With the recent resignation of the Rutgers basketball coach for verbal and sometimes physical abuse of his players, with the recent troubles at UNC Chapel Hill, the problems with Penn State, has something gone terribly wrong in college athletics? I'll start with the collegiate people. Peter?
I think the issue is the influence of money and television exposure, people wanting to find the brass ring to win it all and all that comes with that. We've lost our way a little bit at some levels of collegiate athletics in terms of what we're actually in the business of doing. And just recently, I was at a meeting of the president of the NCAA, Dr. Mark Emmert, and over 100 collegiate athletic directors in Atlanta at the Final Four. And we had a breakfast to talk about some of the issues in college athletics. And I asked the group collectively that one of the things we have to answer is, what business are we in? Mm-hmm. And we have to come to some agreement. Are we in the education business, the youth development business, or are we in the entertainment business? Are we in the business of making money? And when you lose your perspective, then you have these kinds of things happening, people cheating, people treating athletes inappropriately, all for the sake of trying to win at all costs. And that's not the business that we're supposed to be in.
Well, that was going to be my question. Have we let this thing, this college athletic thing, get out of hand so that the coaches and the athletic directors just simply can't resist doing whatever it takes to win because the pressures are so hard?
Yeah, when people get fired because they don't win enough games, you send a message to everybody about what your priorities are. And so if you have people that are doing a good job treating athletes the appropriate way, having competitive teams but maybe not championship teams, and yet you still decide that you want to fire them, then you've sent a strong message to everybody else that you're going to recruit to come to that school, to come to coach at that school, those that are currently at the school, of where your priorities are. And so you can't, you know, if we continue to talk out of both sides of our mouth, we're going to continue to have people that are going to push the rules and abuse young people because they're so desirous of the benefits that accrue when you win and so concerned about losing their job.
Professors get tenure so that they can't be fired. Should college football and basketball coaches and other coaches, particularly in the big money sports where the pressure is intense, particularly at the bigger schools where they field these remarkable teams that garner remarkable alumni support and TV ratings and therefore TV revenue, should those coaches be protected, Dr. Richards?
Well, I have a very different perspective on higher education administration in general. And, you know, when I think about the things behind an institution that make them work, athletics are a huge portion of that, right? They're endorsements from corporations. There are big names there. And it puts the institution on a center stage that perpetuates that investment. When I think about Northeastern, and Peter can speak to this more eloquently than I can, we made a conscientious decision a number of years ago to eliminate our football program. Very controversial topic, did not sit well with many of the alumni in the area who had been through that. But the president made a bold decision to say, look, we're not competing in this space. Our priorities as an academic institution have shifted here. We're known for our global experiential learning. We want students to select us for this. Didn't mean we eliminated all of our athletic programs. You know, Peter has some very successful teams in other areas, but took the focus away from football, which tends to be one of those sports that is highlighted and you see more often, you know, where it's bringing some controversy. So, Peter, I don't know if you want to add to that in terms of priorities of the institution.
And Peter, were you there when they decided to eliminate football?
Yeah, I was there, all right. I was the one that had to meet with the team on a Sunday evening to tell them that they were no longer going to have a football program. So,
how'd that go?
you can imagine. You can imagine. And yet, fast forward 3 years, and yesterday at the end of the day, I met with one of those players that was told that night that he was no longer going to have a chance to play football at Northeastern, who was only a sophomore at the time and was the starting quarterback. And that young man wanted to meet with me. We got together to talk about how his career has gone. We allowed players to transfer, and they were allowed to play right away by the NCAA, and we honored their scholarships if they chose that to come back to finish their degrees at Northeastern, which a number of them did, and this young man was one of them. And so he was finishing up. His last exam was today. And he carried himself with such grace and class, always a real gentleman, even though he was cut to the core, and we talked about that. We talked about how that all felt. But that's an example of someone that we tried to help even after we delivered that bad news. You know, we committed to providing our student athletes with a positive experience. And we're not naive to think that if you lose more than you win, that that's going to necessarily always be positive. And so our job is to try to figure out ways to help our teams be competitive so that when they step on the field or the ice or in the pool, that they feel like they can compete with those they play against every weekend. And in football, we just weren't able to do that on an ongoing basis. And the reason that we felt like that was the case was our facility just wasn't up to the standard of others that we competed against. And so if we couldn't find a solution to that, we didn't think that the status quo was appropriate. And because of the amount of money that it was going to take for us to improve the facility or change the facility, we made the decision that that wasn't in the university's best interest long term and that that money might be better spent elsewhere. And so we made the very difficult decision. So, you know, it's about trying to be consistent with your values. And I think that's where we come off the rails at times in college athletics. What are the values that we espouse, which is going to drive the decisions that we make? What's the reason for what it is that we do? And I challenge the folks in our Masters in Sports Leadership program all the time. The very first time I meet with them, I ask them for the why. Why do you want to lead in sport? Because the answer to that question is going to drive all the decisions that you make from then on.
Fred Whitfield, if there's anybody at the table who understands money, it's got to be you, because you're involved in professional athletics where the money is enormous and the stakes are high, both for the owners and the leadership of the team, but also for the players who are there to make as much money as they can in their pretty short careers when you come right down to it. How much of that, the idea that at the pot at the end of the rainbow for a college athlete is a position on the Bobcats or the Lakers or some professional football team, and that drives their desire to play, that helps to drive the pressure to make that team that they're playing on in college the best it can be. How much of that comes from the pros offering these enormous contracts?
Well, I think it starts, at a very young age with most professional athletes. You know, they don't just get to college and decide they want to be a pro athlete. In this day and time, AAU basketball has gotten huge around the country. And so kids start at 7 and 8 years old really trying to follow that dream of being a professional athlete. And when they look and determine who their role models are going to be, oftentimes their role models happen to be the guys they see on TV mm-hmm. playing the professional game. Mm-hmm. And the salaries are very public on what our players make. The average salary in the NBA is about $5 million a year now. And so when you look at literally every town that our teams are in, our athletes are earning in the top 1% earning bracket in literally every city.
But how realistic is that? Even if you're pretty good in high school or you're pretty good in college, how realistic is it that you will end up on an NBA team?
Well, it's very rare. You know, the percentages say less than 1% of all the kids in the world that want to be professional basketball players actually are able to achieve that goal. You know, there are 428, I think, NBA players in the league, in the NBA. And so when you look at all these kids that are playing around the country and now around the world, basketball has really become more of a global sport. You know, the percentages decrease even more. So, you know, what we tell kids in our basketball camps that we have for kids, not only the Bobcats youth camps, but also I've been running a basketball camp for kids now 29 years. I try to tell these kids that they need to use basketball as a means to an end. Hopefully they'll become a pro athlete, but if not, use basketball as a tool to get a free college education, maybe even a free master's degree. I was fortunate enough to get both for free as a college athlete and as an assistant coach at the collegiate level. And then decide if you aren't quite good enough to be a professional athlete, what else you can do to earn a great living and enjoy your career.
But as the situation at UNC Chapel Hill demonstrated, we sometimes lose sight of that fact and go off the rails, because there are a lot of athletes who are not getting any education because they don't have to go to class. They're all crib classes or don't show up classes, or you write a one-page paper and you get an A. How did academics who run these institutions lose sight of that? They're giving out these mammoth scholarships to these kids and then not giving them an education. It's immoral.
Peter, do you want to address it, or you want me to jump in here now?
Yeah, I would say I'd like.
Well, I'll tell you what, Peter. Yeah. I asked a question that I can't get an answer to in the time allotted. So let me come back from the break and get the answer to that question from you. Peter Roby's with us. He's the athletic director of Northeastern University. Dr. Cheryl Richards is the CEO and regional dean there here in Charlotte, actually. And Fred Whitfield is president and CEO of Charlotte Bobcats Sports and Entertainment. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Invest Collegiate, Charlotte's new public charter school, opening July 2013. Information meetings May 14th, 7 p.m., or May 18th, 9 a.m. at Charlotte School of Law. InvestCollegiate.org. And the Autism Society of North Carolina, working to improve lives of individuals and families affected by autism through advocacy, training, education, and direct services. AutismSocietyOfNC.org. The Mint Museum is hosting the Food Conference, concentrating on food, objects, objectives, and design. There's the key word. And tomorrow, Nationally, internationally known designer Michael Graves will join us and give us some insight into good design. And later in the program, we find out how you design a Broadway season and how you decide what comes to town and how Charlotte is moving up the ladder in terms of getting attractions sooner than bigger cities. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the fertilizer plant explosion in Texas raises questions about the safety of similar facilities around the country, concerns over how fertilizer plants are regulated, and risks to the public.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks, here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about ethics and sports and rebuilding brands and keeping things on the straight and narrow. And Peter Robey, I had to interrupt before we talked about this, but the question before the break was, how do academics allow, once they hand out these athletic scholarships to young people, to play and grace their fields and courts, how do they allow them to not then get a college education when that is, as Mr. Whitfield from the Bobcats pointed out, the one thing that most of them without question can carry away from the experience and make their lives better because they're not going to end up playing professional sports in all likelihood?
Well, I mean, if you think about some of the brands you're talking about, athletics there is iconic, and people are human. They get swept up in all of that as well. And so if they can be involved somehow with things that are associated with that particular athletic department and those particular athletes, they too sometimes succumb to the whims of collegiate athletics. And, you know, we're talking about individuals. We're talking about human beings that are going to make mistakes and lose their way. And the issue is what is in place to help people understand what is important and how do people get promoted and incentivized to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And when we don't see people acting in ways that are consistent with the values that you've espoused, what happens to them?
Let's back up and just talk about the whole idea of college athletic scholarships. The purpose mm-hmm. of college is to get an education. Why are we giving scholarships to people to play football and basketball and lacrosse and swimming? Why are we doing that?
Well, I think people have decided that was a part of the collegiate experience that added some value, that it was an opportunity to bring a
added
diverse
value,
group of people.
Added value to who or what?
To the community, not just to those student-athletes participating, but, you know, you think about the ways in which collegiate athletics is a vehicle for galvanizing your community, to create a source of pride, to bring people from such diverse backgrounds together. I mean, think about what goes on at the University of Alabama in football, where you have the majority of that football team is African-American, and yet you have a state that over the years has had a history of civil rights issues, and yet now you have black and white players jumping into each other's arms, hugging each other, winning national championships, and the people in the stands are of diverse backgrounds, all cheering for the same thing. What phenomena in society can really kind of do that? And so that's why sports can be so powerful when used in the appropriate way, and why it's so disappointing when people don't get it and abuse it. So there are benefits that accrue to the individuals participating and those that are able to watch it and root for it. And the issue is not to let it get so far out of hand that you lose perspective and the tail starts wagging the dog.
In these schools where college athletics are big in terms of revenue drivers and also attracting people to want to go to the school and alumni to want to give to the school, and I don't want to name any names, but we know the football powerhouses and the basketball powerhouses. In those schools, is more scholarship money devoted to bringing great players into their programs, or is an equal amount of money being given to people who want to major and who have a particular talent for chemistry or physics or English, for that matter?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you that there's an awful lot of money that's dedicated from financial aid for merit-based scholarships for academic stars. every college in the country, every university in the country allocates a certain amount of money, and Cheryl could probably speak to this even better than I, but there is an enrollment management strategy that every university undertakes to try to attract the best and the brightest across a diverse group of academic disciplines and skills. And so that's a great question, Mike, because the sports issue gets the most attention. But there are kids that are considered really high potential academic students with a research bent or a practical application bent, experiential learning interest, whatever it happens to be. And colleges and universities are falling all over themselves to try to offer them financial aid packages, merit-based scholarships to get them to matriculate at their institution because it's going to drive their brand and it's hopefully going to attract additional scholars down the road.
I think Fred talked about that. You know, you said you went undergraduate and graduate on an athletic scholarship. I received my master's degree on an academic scholarship and on an experiential scholarship that not only paid for my experience but then paid me. So I wasn't one of those poor, starving college students as I was doing my graduate work. So I think there are both, Mike. You know, there are academic scholarships, there are civic scholarships, there are sports scholarships. And Peter really nailed it on the head when he said it's a balance of those. It's a brand issue for a lot of institutions. It's where your priorities reside. And I think one of the earlier questions that you asked in the segment, Peter responded, it's a difference between making money or finding an education. And it starts before they even get to the colleges, right?
Right. That's correct. That's correct.
And we've talked about the pressures, and I think we understand them on a peripheral basis, but I don't think we really understand what it's like to be the president of a college or and have this magnificent football program like Penn State had with the Nittany Lions, and what that meant to the college and therefore the pressures that were involved in not talking about Jerry Sandusky's behavior and just keeping things status quo. Just be quiet about it. We're making money here. We're having a great season here, et cetera. What was the impact of having that great team, and what will be the impact of not having that great team on Penn State?
Well, we're going to find out just how much people actually love Penn State for Penn State and how much they actually love Penn State because they could be associated with a national championship caliber football program. And so at the end of the day, maybe it'll be the best thing that ever happened to Penn State because people will have to decide whether they love Penn State for Penn State or they love Penn State because of Penn State football and Joe Paterno. Yeah. And, you know, I had people when we made the decision around football that would email me or send me letters or send our president letters saying that you could not be a first-rate academic institution without football. That's how much people are brainwashed about football. That's how we've been socialized around football. Mm-hmm. Is because it gets all the attention in the media. And because it gets all the attention on
that brings
campus.
Us to another yeah. question, because I remember the days when college athletics were college athletics and the pros were pros. And now the college teams have pretty much become farm teams in many cases, not just basketball, but football as well, for professional athletics. And sometimes when colleges get into trouble, they get into trouble because of rules set up by the NCAA that just seem foolish in the modern world. Either we're going to follow the NCAA rules and treat them like the gold standard, or we're not. And you get sometimes athletes get into trouble because they're not making any money. They can't live. They can't get a part-time job at McDonald's because of the NCAA. And so they can't live as well as some other students. So what would be wrong with abolishing all those rules, admitting that these teams are farm teams for professional teams down the road, and that you're fielding a team simply to wear your team's colors and name on the backs of their jerseys? Wouldn't that eliminate a lot of the ethical violations that we're skirting around here today?
It absolutely would. the club system that we have all over the world, except in North America, would actually maybe be better, so that instead of people hiding behind the facade of an institution of higher education, just create a club program.
And what would be wrong with that? What would be wrong with that?
That's a good question. I've actually been throwing that idea out there. I've mentioned it in some of the meetings I've had with the NCAA folks, that maybe that is, in fact, the model that we should adopt, like they do in Europe with Barcelona and Real Madrid and Liverpool and Manchester United, where they have a feeder system and they create programs that start at 10 years old and they cultivate talent And if that talent is good enough, they invest in it and they become part of their major club. And so if they want to go to school, they go to school on their own. But it has nothing to do with being a student. Right now, we don't have that system. And so one thing that the public needs to understand about, quote-unquote, the NCAA, that's an association of member institutions, and we pass the rules. So there's no nobody to point a finger at. Everybody's pointing a finger at Mark Emmert, the president of the NCAA. He's just administering the rules that the membership has passed. And so there's a process in place. If we didn't want certain rules, we could eliminate them.
Let me get your perspective, Mr. Whitfield. You're a professional in the world of professional athletics. Would it be a good thing for you? Would it be a good thing, having been a college athlete and coach yourself, to abolish these rules and just admit what these teams are in some cases?
Well, it's interesting because Peter's exactly right. The club teams over in Europe and around the world really have young people focusing on that skill and that career as a future vocation for them. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the players...
Are they attached to colleges and schools over there, or are they just
well, like
just
Peter
small
said,
teams?
You know, the educational piece becomes secondary.
Right. But are they attached to schools? They are attached to schools?
Yeah, but it's
the
on
clubs,
their own.
The clubs are not attached to schools. The kids can decide that they want to go to school
they're on their own.
Okay.
Yeah,
and
it's
so,
up to them and their family.
And the kids actually become pros at a very young age and actually get paid by these club teams. And many of those kids, when they become 19 years old, are drafted into our league. We drafted a young man, Bismack Biyombo, last year that came out of the club system. And those kids work on basketball 8 hours a day as opposed to going to class 8 hours a day. So their focus is completely different.
As long as we have the system that we have, is part of the problem the fact that the NBA and the NFL – will take a look at a 19-year-old college player and draft them or offer them the opportunity to be drafted. What 19-year-old could turn down that opportunity? I couldn't have. But then they short-circuit their academic career. What would happen if the pros said, we're not drafting anybody till you graduate?
Well, again, you know, it's not quite that easy.
Why not?
You know, you've got a players association that's negotiating on behalf of every young man that wants to come into the NBA. And if the players association had their way, kids would be allowed to come right out of high school again. Mm-hmm. So there's a negotiation that goes on between the owners and the players to try and find the appropriate time to allow young people to pursue their career of choice. And the argument has always been made that any 18-year-old that wants to go out and pursue a career in plumbing or, you know, wants to be a painter, wants to do any other vocation, has the right to earn a living. Well, a player that's talented enough to enter the NBA has that right to go out and be able to pursue their career opportunities.
You obviously you keep an eye on college and high school athletes.
Yes.
In your position. And the students know that. The kids in high school and college know that, and they know they're being watched, and they want to do their best, and they want to play for teams that feature them and teams that are going to win so that they even get more attention from you. How much pressure does that put then on, because you've been both in the professional world and the academic world, how much pressure does that put on colleges and athletic directors and presidents of college to field great teams, to attract great players, et cetera?
I think it puts an enormous pressure on them because, again, you know, at the collegiate level, winning really is what it's all about. And so you've got athletic directors that are trying to go out and find the absolute best coaches they can find to lead their programs. You've got coaches going out and trying to recruit the most talented athletes to come in. And oftentimes knowing that a lot of these athletes are only going to play for them for 1 year. Mm-hmm. But that 1 year may have an enormous impact on their university, on their alumni base, on the contributions that are given by the alumni. If those 1 year players are good enough to help win a national championship like a Kentucky.
And as a regional dean for an academic institution, you can speak for all college presidents in the country.
No pressure, Cheryl.
Wow. Thanks for the setup, Mike.
You're welcome. Why is it that these colleges feel that they must have a great team and a great coach, and they must offer scholarships to players that they know will only be there for a year because the Bobcats or the Knicks are going to draft these players like that?
Yeah, well, I think the same
Why?
Thing. It doesn't have to be limited to college, Mike. I mean, I think you see it's an economic question, right? We're having the same conversation in Charlotte now with the Panthers. Why do you want the Panthers Stadium to stay in Charlotte? It's an economic driver. right?
It brings people in.
It brings revenue into the city. It brings jobs into the city. And as Peter said earlier, it brings a sense of commonality and community for diverse groups of people who may not otherwise connect. So sports as an industry and as a vehicle is not just its impact in college and what college presidents are doing to bring those athletes in. It extends all the way through our professional sports in the community.
Yeah, and you know, we run and manage Time Warner Cable Arena, and to Cheryl's point, the economic impact by us bringing a college basketball tournament, we host a college basketball tournament, the CIAA tournament, which is a historically black college conference. And it's a $40 million plus a year economic impact to our Charlotte community for a four-day period. We've put in a bid to hopefully host one or more of the upcoming ACC tournaments that they put out for bid. It's a huge economic impact for our region, and having those collegiate sports come into our building are every bit as valuable as our NBA team playing their 43 games. Our goal is to have our building busy 150 to 200 days a year with literally every type of event you can have in the building, major concert, family show, college basketball tournaments, college games, of course, our 43 home games, minor league hockey games. Sports have that sort of impact on a community, and you'll see the economic growth around arenas in uptown areas, such as our arena, such as the Washington, D.C. building, the Verizon Center. All of the economic impact that has hit that area of Chinatown in D.C. has been phenomenal, and we've seen the exact same kind of growth in uptown Charlotte, and much of it is right around our building.
And that can be extrapolated down to the college level as well? Is that what you're saying?
No doubt.
Yeah, no doubt.
No doubt. I mean, some of those major college programs, the seating capacity for the football stadium is bigger than the actual population of the surrounding region. And so, you know, you get an area where they have a 90,000-seat stadium or an 80,000-seat stadium, and people come in for the entire weekend. Some people are driving their RVs in there in the middle of the week and parking and frequenting the local establishments and buying products and spending money. It has an impact. And so that's a big part of it. And, you know, there's others that if not for their football or basketball programs, people wouldn't even know very much about the school outside of the region. I mean, at the University of Connecticut, where I grew up in Connecticut, University of Connecticut, when I grew up in the 60s and the 70s in Connecticut, was a regional institution. It was a part of the Yankee Conference Athletic Conference, but it was a regional agricultural school. When when the Big East was formed and ESPN came to be at the same time, mind you, 1979, both of those entities were born. The University of Connecticut started to get exposure to all over the country and had a number of great players that came from the West Coast. Now, how in the heck would you expect a University of Connecticut, an ag school in Storrs, Connecticut, to attract a kid from Los Angeles or from Seattle or from San Diego? It was because of the power of the brand and being on television on Big Monday and then going to the Big East tournament in Madison Square Garden, and kids start thinking, I can see myself playing for those guys. They don't even think about the fact that they're going to be spending 4 years in Storrs. They're thinking about playing Big East basketball. And all of a sudden, the University of Connecticut's brand is totally different than it was 25 years ago.
Peter Roby is athletic director of Northeastern University. He joins us by phone from Boston. In our studio, Dr. Cheryl Richards, the CEO and regional dean of the school here in Charlotte, and Fred Whitfield with the Bobcats. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and CPCC Skyline Run, a 5K race and family fun event that sponsors or supports student scholarships this Saturday, April 27th. Details at cpccfoundation.com/skyline. The fertilizer plant explosion in West Texas raises questions about the safety of similar facilities around the country, concerns over how fertilizer plants are regulated, and risks to the public. The topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, and every other way imaginable, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Charlotte neighborhoods are divided into a wealthy wedge and a crescent of poverty. One subsidizes the other.
That's going to be a $4 billion increase in the value of properties in the Crescent, funded 50% by taxes paid by people in the wedge. It's an affront.
Join WFAE for a public conversation called One Charlotte or Many, Thursday evening at Spirit Square. RSVP at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're sitting here talking about ethics and sports, the role of sports in our society, the role of sports at the college level, etc., with Dr. Cheryl Richards and Peter Roby from Northeastern University, and Fred Whitfield, who's the president and COO of the Charlotte Bobcats, Charlotte Bobcats Sports and Entertainment. We were talking about branding and the importance of television exposure to attract good athletes to colleges, et cetera. And you wanted to follow up on what Peter Roby was talking about, Dr. Richards.
Yeah, Mike. So, you know, I mean, I think Peter brought up a really great point, which is the branding and how does a young individual, whether or not they're interested in athletics or academics, find an institution that isn't otherwise on the radar. And, you know, I was naive coming into it in my career early on as an admissions counselor, thinking that athletics did not play a key role in the branding of an institution. And I will tell you that I was sadly mistaken in that when you go out and you're recruiting for just students, not athletes, not the top scholars or anything, your name in amongst a room of other colleges there, you have to figure out a way to differentiate yourself. And in many cases, the students have a visual identity or a name recognition with an institution that has strong athletic programs, right? It's why the University of Florida can go into a ballroom and have a flock of students who come to them, and a Colorado State University, you know, doesn't really have a large football program, doesn't get that kind of attention. Once then, that becomes the first layer of the onion. Then you start to peel back and you get to Fred's point, which is 1% of those kids coming out of the collegiate programs will actually end up playing professional sports. But it's what gets them to the table.
And part of the branding issue is also, with college athletics, is what conference you're playing in. I know, Peter, that you feel that conference realignment is something that's troubling. My alma mater is leaving the ACC to go, I think, to the Big Ten, University of Maryland. And yeah. Notre Dame is coming into the ACC, which makes no sense at all to me. But it's all about money, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So why is this conference realignment, which is happening with more than those schools, why is that troubling to you?
Oh, because it's really being made for one reason or two reasons, which is the impact of football and the money that it drives with respect to television, and yet you've got athletic programs that sponsor 18, 20, 22 different sports, and yet those athletes are going to be forced to get up in the wee hours of the morning to get to the airport to go fly halfway across the country to play an individual game and then fly right back, missing all kinds of class and the impact that it's going to have on their academic pursuits, while the teams that are actually the reason that those realignments are happening, those teams are flying charter. The football team is going to charter a plane. They're going to be able to leave, come and go whenever they want. They'll be back in bed before you know it. Whereas the teams that are really going to be the bulk of the impact are going to have to get on a commercial flight and get to the airport, leave campus at 4:30 in the morning for a 6 o'clock flight, play and come back. And, you know, so there are so many other athletes that are being impacted, and it's really not in the spirit of what the camp – when conferences were formed many, many years ago, it was in order to bring a commonality to the competition and to allow people from a geographic standpoint and from a demographic standpoint and a profile of the institution to play together to compete on common ground.
And this gets us back to something you said very early in the program, and that is that colleges and universities, particularly their athletic program, well, the colleges and universities themselves have to decide what business they are in. All the things that we've talked about, how do they make that decision? I mean, every time we talk about the influence of money or the influence of alumni support, or the importance of athletics, that all in this conversation, that always seems to trump academics. Always.
Yeah. Well, you create the monster and then you have to feed it. And so that's where we're at now. You know, it's like now in order to justify the decisions that we make, we're actually having to go back and talk about what it is that we've created. And we've created a monster now that it has become the be-all and end-all. And so when you when you've put yourself in a position where you've got your teams traveling all over the country to play, now you start looking for additional ways to generate revenue in order to allow them to be able to do that. And so the tail keeps wagging the dog, as opposed to making decisions based on what's in the best interest of your overall athletic program and your student-athletes, regardless of how much money you're going to make, and get back to the core mission of the institution. I know it sounds naive, and I get told that all the time, but I'm not going to stop fighting windmills when it comes to that stuff, because at the end of the day, I keep reminding myself of what business I'm in. I'm in the business of educating young people for a life of achievement and fulfillment.
Dr. Richard.
And so that's what I'm going to continue to focus on.
Yeah, and I don't want to say that Northeastern has figured out the magic mix of ingredients in the bowl, but I will say, you know, we talked about closing down our football program. Peter, what was that, three seasons ago. And yet this past year, we had the highest number of undergraduate applicants of any private university in the United States, almost 45,000 kids who applied for 2,800 spots. Wasn't all for athletics, because we stuck to a core mission of what we're trying to do, and so the revenue's coming in other ways now.
I don't want this program to end without our talking about the role model aspect of athletes in society at large, but at the college level, at the high school level too, the role models for these kids have to be the coaches and the athletic directors. And I know that you played, Peter, for a coach who considered himself to be an educator, and you were a coach, Mr. Whitfield, at the college level. So what is the role of a coach at the college level?
Well, I think the coach plays sort of a dual role. You know, the coach, well, actually three roles, a coach, a teacher, and also another father figure. And most very successful coaches that really care about their players are not just interested about what happens on the floor or on the football field.
Mm-hmm.
They're concerned about helping mold and well-round a young man to be able to be successful in life. And so to be able to have a coach, I had a great college coach, Danny Roberts, who was like a second father to me, and counseled me on things outside of sports, on career, you know, what I should focus on academically, what my opportunities would be like down the road if I did X, Y, Z.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the great coaches have done that. I know Coach K does it at Duke. I know Dean Smith and Roy Williams have done it at Chapel
Hill. So when you have coaches like Bobby Knight, or you have coaches like the guy at Rutgers who throw chairs and push players and verbally abuse them, are they the exception?
I think they are. I mean, you know, but I think, you know, you really have to look at all the facts and the relationships that these coaches have built with their athletes rather than just isolated incidences. I know, you know, Bobby Knight's players live and die by him. They all seem to really still love him.
Yeah.
And so there are exceptions when, you know, maybe coaches get outside the lines of what the norm is. But it's a player-coach relationship that outside people sometimes just don't quite understand.
So let's talk about role models, because there was Charles Barkley who said he wasn't a role model, even though, as you said off the air a moment ago, he knows he is, he just doesn't want to be.
And he still is today.
Of course he is. Of course he is. But and college athletes are role models for their younger peers, and high school athletes become role models for their younger brothers and sisters. Is this something that they shoulder willingly? Is this something that they think about? Is this something that they're coached about?
I think you get both. You know, I think there are, Peter said early in the program that people are attracted to this industry because they see big dollar signs, right? Fred, you said, you know, average salary, $5 million. So you got a young kid at 7 years old who's thinking, I want to become a pro basketball player, and I'm looking at a $5 million, you know, figure out
and
there.
And by the way, this is a fun game.
And it's a fun game, and I like this. But that 7-year-old or that 14-year-old or even that 21-year-old isn't necessarily thinking what comes with that mm-hmm. is not only the rights and all of the benefits, but the responsibilities that they have at communities.
Do you talk about that to your player? Do professional athletes get spoken to by the owners and the managers and the coaches about the responsibility that come with these multi-million dollar contracts?
We do, and the NBA does. The NBA is very involved in player development, and that doesn't just mean on the floor. It means what your responsibility is out in your community, what your responsibility is carrying yourself as a fine young man, that these young kids, the 7, 8, 10-year-olds that are following our teams, what they want to aspire to be. And so we take a very active role, and obviously our owner, Michael Jordan, has been a role model for years, and he preaches to our young players, it's very important for you to build your own brand positively because it helps us build our Bobcats brand positively, and it's not just on the court. It's out in the community. It's giving back to causes in our community that really need help. It's really about touching our season ticket holders, touching our sponsors, you know, giving high fives to the kids that line the rails at our games because our games are a family environment, and our kids help drive our business.
When's he coming on this program? I'll throw that out there because I haven't done it
before. If I could just add to that, you know, here at Northeastern, we have a set of core values, one of which is critical thinking skills, and we want to help our student-athletes develop their critical thinking skills. And what we mean by that is, look, instead of us telling you how to live your life or what to do and what not to do, what we want our kids to do when they first arrive is to focus on what their goals are. So what are your goals as an athlete? What are your goals on a team? What are your goals academically? What are your goals individually? And then make decisions that are consistent with you achieving those goals. And so if you start to make decisions that are not in your best interest in terms of you achieving your goals, then you have to ask yourself, why are you doing that? Are you doing it because somebody else is asking you to do that? Are you doing that because it's the easier way to do it? We've got to make a connection so that they understand. It's not just us telling them, do it because you're not going to embarrass us. But do it because it's going to be what's in your best interest. And then when they don't do it, hold them accountable. And that's the piece that we have to keep emphasizing, whether it's at the high school level, the youth sport level, the collegiate level, or the professional level. We're going to treat you like adults. Okay? And you need the freedom to make your own decisions. And then when you don't do them that way, then you're going to be held accountable because that's how society is.
And let me just add one piece. You know, we draft players or we sign players as free agents. Mm-hmm. Before we draft any player, we've done a heavy amount of background research on all of these young men to see what their character's like, what their background has been like. And we've been very fortunate. We have great players on our team that we don't have to push out and say, you should be a role model or you should do positive things in the community. They actually enjoy doing it. They have fun doing things out in the community, and that's part of the character that they're made up of.
Dr. Richards, both you and Peter Roby, your athletic director, see student athletes as people who can accomplish a positive social change. Talk about that.
Well, you know, so you think about athletes in our society and as role models. One of the commitments that we've made as a university is to talk about social issues. So front and center here in our community now is bullying, right? It's been all over the news of late, and bully prevention. So we have resources at the university that we are then connecting with, you know, over 400 student athletes, and the coaches up at UNC Charlotte have been through the program. We just had a conversation this morning with CMS about how do we bring some resources to bear to really go further into the pipeline so that we're hitting these kids at a young age so that we're using high school athletes as role models for middle school sports and middle school athletes as role models for elementary school kids. And you're filling the bucket, right? You're mm-hmm. paying it forward along this way. So I think that's part of the impact of sports in our society is not just what happens on the court, but what you're doing for betterment of a community and your obligation to that community and having that conversation younger and younger.
And I think to Cheryl's point, it really brings more visibility and more high profile to causes that need to be addressed. And when colleges or professional teams like ours go out and seek out causes that need attention, it makes those causes more visible to the public at large.
What are some of those causes?
We have three major causes: hunger, wellness, and education are the three pillars that we build all of our community relations platforms around. Mm-hmm. And when we went out last week and co-sponsored with Lowe's, our partner, a book bus that's going to travel around to all the Title I schools, and we've got all the media out, you know, really understanding why we're doing this because of the lack of literacy, then that raises that cause to a level that the general public is saying, okay, there's a literacy problem in our community. When we, you know, gave $250,000 to buy a mobile health care unit with Presbyterian Hospital that provides quality health care on our community care cruiser, you know, that brings visibility to the health care issues out in our community and those that can't afford health care. And so when we attack those type causes, put money behind it, and bring our athletes, our assets out, our coaching staff, and the media follows, then, you know, they saw 3 years ago that there was a problem in CMS and saving middle school sports because Michael Jordan presented a check for $250,000 on our behalf to CMS schools to save middle school sports. The following year, Mr. Hendrick jumped right in and made another contribution to continue the effort. And so I think raising the visibility on issues out in the community, colleges and professional teams can do that and then have the community at large say, hey, you know, that's a cause that I believe in that I want to invest in to make things better.
Peter, prior to your being the university's, Northeastern University's athletic director, you were director of Northeastern Center for Sport in Society, whose mission is, quote, to educate, support, and unite leaders to use sport as a vehicle for strengthening our local and global communities and to empower the sports community to work together in ensuring that every person has the opportunity to develop within a safe, healthy, and inclusive environment in order to become a self-aware, contributing member of society. That's a long quote. It's admirable. It's lofty. How do you accomplish it?
Well, the beauty of that is that you can have a conversation with a group of young people who aspire to be athletes about things that they would ordinarily not really be all that interested in. And because it's the power of sport and bringing them together. So example is if you had a team or a conference full of athletes or a little league program, and you went out to each program through their coaching staffs and you trained the coaching staffs to have a conversation with their kids about bullying, you would get their attention in a way that you could never do it in an assembly in a high school or in a middle school. Because they are so in tune with what their coach wants them to do, they look at the coach as the father figure, the person that's going to be the difference between them getting on the field and not getting on the field. And so you've got their undivided attention. And if you put it in the context where it really resonates, because they trust that coach to do what's in their best interest, then you have a chance to have a powerful impact.
And you get the last word because we're out of time. Peter Robies, athletic director of Northeastern University up in Boston. He joined us by phone. Dr. Cheryl Richards in our studio because she's here in Charlotte. She's the CEO and regional dean of Northeastern University here. And Fred Whitfield, president and CEO of Charlotte Bobcats Sports and Entertainment here as well. Just in case I haven't mentioned it, Michael Jordan is welcome to come on anytime he'd like to.
I'll make sure he knows that. You have fun.